Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, I'm Sophie Ellis-Bextor, and welcome to Spinning Plates, the podcast where I speak to busy working women who also happen to be mothers about how they make it work. I'm a singer, and I've released 7 albums in between having my 5 sons, aged 16 months to 16 years, so I spin a few plates myself. Being a mother can be the most amazing thing, but can also be hard to find time for yourself and your own ambitions. I want to be a bit nosy and see how other people balance everything. Welcome to Spinning Plates. Well, hello. It is a beautiful, sunny Sunday. I am walking back from the river. I just had a coffee with my mum, and I'm walking alongside Jessie, who's doing some Pokemon Going, I think. Is that what you refer to as?
It's called Pokemon Go. It's like a game where, like, you catch Pokemons, and if you want to move in the game, then you have to move in real life.
Great. Well, it's keeping us walking, and it's quite funny, actually, because Jessie just had it where there was a Pokemon he had to catch, and it was outside a house that had a blue plaque, so that's what we were looking for. And to the it's always noisy when I do this. To the untrained eye, it looked like I had a child that was fascinated with blue plaques. Because I went, here we are, Jessie, we've reached the blue plaque of the humorist and reformist MP, whatever his name is. And Jessie went, yes! But really, it's because that's where Pokemon was. So if you ever see a family and you think, oh, they're very cultured, they might just be catching Pokemon. Yes. Sunny Sunday, going home to have roast beef.
My grandma's vegan.
Oh, well done. That's great.
So good.
It's actually all been pretty nice this weekend. I've had a busy few weeks and I've just been loving the fact that this weekend I've had no work, just been at home. It is delightful. And we have Nanny Claire staying with us. So Nanny Claire was our nanny, the first nanny we ever had from when Sonny was 4 months old.
Okay.
All the way until he was 11 years old. She's very much like family. She's currently in my kitchen making her famous Cadbury's tribute cake, which we put a recipe of in our cookbook. Only when we did the test of the recipes, the lovely chef we were working with, Emily Ezekiel, she said, listen, per slice, Claire's Cadbury's tribute cake is more calories than you're supposed to have in one day. So the publishers got a little bit worried and said, oh, you might have your cookbook down as a sort of unhealthy cookbook. So we toned down the recipe so that it wouldn't be so unhealthy. And I've regretted it ever since, actually, because it's a flipping cake, so you already know it's not healthy. And the real recipe is so much better. So I might put it on my Instagram, actually, the real recipe, because it's like, then you get the full impact of the Cadbury's. And that's what Claire's making today. And, oh, I have such a lovely guest for you today. Years and years and years ago, I went to watch a circus show at the Roundhouse in Camden. And there was this woman, I've never forgotten it because it made such an impression on me, who came out on roller skates in a skin-tight leopard print dress, looking very hubba hubba. Oh, yes, Jessie?
I looked up my Pokemons. Let me show you how much I got. Let me show you my Pokemons.
Okay. Look at this!
You've got so many Pokemons. Jessie, we will discuss that properly in a second.
I just started this game.
I know,
today.
But Jessie, let me just finish. Oh, God. Let me just finish telling people about the podcast, please. Yes, and this woman came out looking amazing, very beautiful, very cool. And she had roller skates on and a ton of hula hoops. And she hula hooped and roller skates her way around to Thelma Houston's Don't Leave Me This Way, which is incidentally what cemented it as my favorite disco song of all time. Because it starts off slow, and then by the end, when it gets all crazy, Marowa, the woman in question, was spinning around and then kind of got lifted into the air, spinning hula hoops and a little aerial pulley thing. And it was amazing. I loved it so much. And all the while, she was making kind of cartoony faces, like puffing out her cheeks and kind of looking shocked and surprised and flabbergasted, like kind of really cartoony and fun. And so I started following her on Instagram as soon as I found her on there. And about 2 years ago, she had a baby, and I was like, great, I'll have her as a future guest on Spinning Plates, even though at the time I'd only just started the podcast. So today she is my guest. We spoke on Zoom because she was in, she's actually Australian, but she, well, grew up in Australia, but she's actually, hold on, Jessie, I won't be long. But we spoke on Zoom because she was currently in California, California. And we had a lovely chat, and I think you're going to really like hearing her stories. So yes, over to you, Marowa, and your hula hooping wonderful ways. All right, speak to you in a bit. In the meantime, I know, Jessie, we're going to talk about Pokemon. Yeah, I'm going to catch some Pokemon while we're listening in. All right, see you on the other side. I've actually been so excited to talk to you because I first saw you perform, I think it must be around 15 years ago, at the Roundhouse in London.
Quite possibly.
And you're responsible actually for giving me a love of one of my favorite songs, because you know when you have a song and then something crystallizes the moment of the song and the image, and you did a whole routine on your roller skates with your hula hoops to Thelma Houston's Don't Leave Me This Way.
Don't Leave Me This
and
Way.
Yeah. I believe it finished with you being elevated, you were aerial by the end.
Yep.
And
yep.
It was so magic. That it literally is one of my favorite songs, but I always think of you when I hear it.
Oh, nice. And it's got those great builds and key changes in it, and it just kept getting the root. It just gets, till the bit where I'm in the air and there was a glitter cannon, and it was a whole thing.
Yes. So what's going on in your world at the moment? Where are we speaking to you now? I'm like, you're in LA.
Yeah, coming from slightly sunny, but a little bit actually quite cloudy today, LA. April LA. It was like 100 degrees all of last week, so not too hot this week, thankfully. Yeah. Just surviving, coming out of the weirdest couple of years. I think we've all just happy to be alive and still standing at this point.
Yes. So are you sort of back with your work? Because obviously, so you were saying your little boy is 18 months now.
Yeah, I had in some ways what I think is just the absolute most dream pregnancy run, which is that I got pregnant in January of 2020, and sort of thought, oh, I'm going to have to cancel all my work and I'm going to have to tell everyone and shows and it's going to be complicated and I'm not going to be able to travel. And then the world just like shut down around me. And then people were calling saying, oh, we've had to cancel this show. And I just thought, this is amazing. This is brilliant. And then I, like to keep my personal life kind of personal and private. And so it was this amazing thing where no one knew, like, you know, those that needed to know needed, but in terms of work, no one knew. And then, you know, had the baby, which obviously there were a lot of downsides. It was lockdown. My family's in Australia. I couldn't see them. And there was no vaccine at that point. So it was all a bit, scary, but we got through it. And then when the world started opening up again and shows were coming back and people were calling saying, can you come and do the show? I was like, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I just managed to skip the whole bit. And then I was like, oh yeah. And I had a baby. Don't worry about it. Because I think, you know,
were you already a bit worried then about the idea of having to not work for a little bit?
Yeah, I definitely was like, you know, looking for the gap and trying to work out, you know, as someone who has definitely suffered from a lot of FOMO in the past. And also the idea of like, I wasn't under any illusion of how much work was going to be required to have a child. It's not just, you know, the pregnancy part. It's the recovery. It's the looking after. It's the, you know, having energy. Like it's not just like, oh, and then I got a nanny and then I went and did the work, because you're exhausted. So it's like, how do you balance all the parts together, and when's the best time? And you know, there's never a good time, but I do feel like somehow I lucked out and it sort of fit a really natural gap that actually came up anyway. Yeah.
And so have you now gone back to doing your day job, so to speak?
Yes, yes. And I kind of had already been sort of, I spent nearly, more than 10 years traveling and touring, performing, dragging hula hoops from one side of the world to the other, and a lot of roller skates and a lot of oversized luggage in various airports, and was very aware that, you know, there was no version, at least I'm sure there are people out there that can do it, but I wasn't really interested in also trying to have a child and the hoops and the roller skates and be touring and traveling and running around. and so, you know, I think when I started out, it was that thing of, I didn't want to be trapped in a 9-to-5. I didn't want to be stuck, you know, in one place. I wanted to be able to move around. And so I'd found this career that allowed me to do that. And I was thrilled with myself and thought it was really clever. And then after a few years, I was like, oh my God, I'm trapped in this version. I can't stop. I have to keep touring and I can't stop touring. And I want to stay in one place now. And then, so, you know, it took a few years to then come up with the next plan and work out how I could stay in one place and pick and choose the shows that I really wanted to do, versus have been forced to continue traveling like that. So I feel really, really lucky, that it worked out that way. And so now, you know, I can do the shows that I really want to do. And then a lot of my work is also just online now with the shop that I have, and the writing and things that I do, so I can do it from wherever I am.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you said trapped in 9-to-5, that is, yeah, literally the last thing that you are, I would say. And you're sort of magnificently hard to put down to any one thing, really, because there's lots of things that you go up to, from, yeah, teaching to writing to world record breaking. And obviously the core of it is your performance. So how long have you been doing the stuff with the hula hoops and the roller skates?
I was a late bloomer in circus terms, because I didn't actually start circus school until I was 21, which is, the idea of going to school for circus is kind of ridiculous anyway. Getting a Bachelor of Circus Arts is always like, do you really need a degree to join the circus? Not really, but but it was handy. So, yeah, I was a late bloomer in that sense. And I'd been roller skating my whole – I've been roller skating since I was two. I had tiny, tiny
– Wow, since you actually were two?
Yeah, and I just –
That must have looked adorable,
went,
by the way.
They're very, very cute, but not as cute, I think, as the ones that I'm getting for my son, which I got yesterday. I took because, you know, you can get shoes modified into skates, and so obviously he has a really tiny, tiny little foot. So I've got tiny, tiny little boots. Timberland boots that are going to be, oh my God, they're going to be so beautiful.
I just love that. You're like, purple, you've learned to walk. Brilliant. Wheels. Let's put wheels on it.
Yeah, because, but you know, to be fair, he keeps putting his feet in my skates anyway, which are obviously up to his knees, you know,
yeah.
and he just points at them and he puts them on, and then I have to sort of walk him, or, you know, roll him around the house. He loves it. So I thought, okay, it's time.
Oh my gosh, that is going to look amazing when you take him out and about on his little roller skate Timberland boots. That's amazing.
<Yeah.
laughs> So what are you, I suppose your early memories, and if you were doing it from two, what made you first put your foot inside a roller skate?
My mum.
So is she in, is she, something she did?
She works at university. Both my parents are quite academic, but she roller skated. She did roller skate, and she got me these tiny little pair of roller skates out of the Trading Post, which, you know, I guess is the Craigslist of that era. They were $20 and they had big orange wheels, and I learned in them, and then my brother and my sister and my other brother, you know, went down the chain. And so, you know, I loved skating. I just loved it. And because I started so young, it just has always felt second nature. I've never had to really think about it. And when I started teaching, I had to sort of really go back to learn how to teach it, because to me it was just like, well, you just put them on and you go,
yeah.
Like, rather than having to break down how to do it. And then obviously the circus stuff was much later. I did gymnastics and I did rhythmic gymnastics. So I had had experience with a single hoop in rhythmic, but obviously the circus stuff was different, and multiple hoops, and it just, looking back, it all kind of makes sense. At the time, I don't think I knew where I was going with it.
Yeah.
It just, I was one of those kids that just, you know, climbed on everything and jumped up and down and couldn't really sit still. And at the time, you know, there wasn't a natural line of, you know, when you get to high school and you go to the career counselor, they don't sort of say, oh, you should do a Bachelor of Circus Arts, because it didn't exist. Like, it was it was a brand new degree when I did the degree. And I remember thinking, you know, when I applied, I was like, well, I don't know, really know what this is, but I know that I like climbing on things, so it made sense.
So when you do a circus degree, when you look sort of left and right around you in the room, what are the people looking for? What they're looking to
It was the dream. When I did it, it was the dream, because it was so new. Yeah. So it was the absolute, to me, it's like, it's similar to when I do world records. It's that thing of like, you know, it's like I always say it's like being in the Marvel comic studios, kind of like you've got one of everything. You've got, you know, the tallest person and the strong man, and then the person is a contortionist, and the person, you know, all these people that specialize. It's exactly why I love world records. It's people who have taken one very specific skill. Actually, I was just back in Melbourne last week, and one of my favourite people there, Tully, who I hadn't seen for a long time, who was also there at the same time as me, and he is a very unassuming, very normal-looking guy, skinny little guy, and his specialty, he spent 3 years with a wooden spoon in his mouth and then the stick of the spoon sticking out of his mouth. And then a wine bottle. He would throw the wine bottle behind his back and then catch the wine bottle, you know, the skinny side up, and balance it on the wooden spoon. And you're just like, well, that's not a trick. I mean, but also, what is that? And then, but then from there, he would flip the wine bottle upside down. He could spin the wine bottle along the length of the wooden spoon and then catch it, like spike it into the wood. I mean, it's the craziest skill.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he was still doing it. I saw him do the show when I was back in Melbourne, and I was like, this is genius.
It really is. But it's also, I mean, I think that's something I've really loved and I found really comforting as well especially during the last couple of years, actually, because I'd look on Instagram and start following all these people who are actually really eccentric with these one, as you say, these one thing they would hone in on and just think, I'm going to make, you know, beautiful miniatures of, I don't know, vintage furniture, and it's going to be tiny and perfect.
Yeah.
And I will just do that all the time, all day, every day. And I just think, well, I'm really glad you exist, but how on earth? It's quite barking, but in such a joyful way, for sure.
Yeah.
And I think now as well, like when you get back on stage, you must be really feeling the love that people are just so excited to see something that's pure joy in that way.
Well, it was really strange, because the first gig that I did back was Dita Von Teese did a on-demand live streamed show, but it wasn't live. It was pre-recorded. So we had done the show in the same theater at the Orpheum Theater downtown in Los Angeles, and it's a just beautiful theater. Mm. Like, you know, everything has been kept in mint condition, and it's, I can't remember how many thousand, but quite a few thousand seats. And it's, you know, it's huge theater, huge stage. And, you know, we've done New Year's Eve there, and it's just, it's amazing. And then it was so bizarre to be in there again. And also I got to bring the baby, which was fun. So he was, I think he was 6 or 7 months at the time. And, you know, got lots of pictures with him backstage with all the performers, and, you know, sitting on Dita's fully Swarovski chair and things like that. You know, just all these great, great shots. Lots of feather boas. But, it was so bizarre to be on, you know, we'd been in isolation for so long, and then double isolation with the baby, and then suddenly being back on the stage, but there was no one in the audience. There was just the cameras, and it was this bizarre way to sort of reintroduce performing again, and then having the show be live streamed. So then it was that same thing of like watching it happen through the phone and people commenting through the phone, and then, you know, versus like actually finally being out in front of people again, which is also great.
Well, I can't really imagine how it must feel to go through your pregnancy at times, you say, when everything shuts down, and then you do your first show back with your only, you know, 6-7 month old baby, and everybody else is talking about how it's their first show back for ages. So you're sort of feeling like it kind of mirrors, but it's not, you would have been feeling like that anyway. So it must be
exactly,
quite weird.
Exactly. That's, yeah, that's what was so weird about the timing. And I think it's really marked how I feel about the lockdown and stuff, because it just, there's a version where I would have been like that anyway. So
yeah.
Before and after, you know, that thing of pre-pandemic, post-pandemic, it's like, well, not that we're almost, well, I don't know where we are, but wherever we're at now, but it's like, oh, that's how it was anyway, because it was pre-baby and post-baby. So there's a sort of, yeah, a mirror there.
Yeah. And in a personal way, how did you feel? Because I'm always interested when women have had babies, they've already got such a strong relationship with their bodies, if it's intrinsic to what you do for a living. Mm-hmm. So how did you find that? What's it like to be pregnant on wheels?
It was so bizarre. The wheels were fine. I felt fine on the wheels, 100% fine.
It looks amazing when you see it, the videos and all stuff. Incredible.
Yeah, and it was really funny because I didn't announce that I was even pregnant online until after I'd even had him because I knew, like, the internet's bad at the best of times, and so plus hormones, I was just like, I'm not even, you know, I went right through. And then so I did post afterwards some videos of me skating, and you can imagine, you know, the people that the very opinionated couch, you know, endangering her baby and all this stuff. And, you know, I've been skating, I felt very confident in how and what my body did and how I could do things. What was interesting to me was that I had no interest at all in picking up a hula hoop. Like, from the moment I knew I was pregnant, you know, you see there are videos, and I know friends who've been pregnant that hula hoop, that do that thing where they spin the hoop, you know, around their bump and things like that. And I thought I'd want to do all that stuff. And immediately I was just like, never, like, no way. Like, I don't want to be hitting this child with a, I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, why would you, you know, I just had no interest in it. But I did still want to skate, and I did skate. And the biggest accident I had, which was terrifying, was getting in the shower at 4 months. And I did the classic, stepped in the shower and started falling backwards, and the core muscles that I relied on were not there. And I just went from, you know, vertical to horizontal in 0.2 of a second, and thought, oh, my God, that's it. I'm dead. Baby's dead. I had a full the most, you know, that thing where you're hearing your voice but you don't realize it's part of your own body, because I just was like, what is happening? And that was the biggest accident I had, was in the shower. But I never for 1 second felt unsteady on the skates, I think because you're also focusing and concentrating more. And I skated up to – well, I skated distance up until I was 6 months, and then I would still skate every now and then right through to the day before.
Oh, wow.
When I was 42 and a couple of days and no signs of any dilation, and they were just, you know, I was just, I had a, you know, I was, I'm sure I would have gone back to Australia at the very start, because the American healthcare system, as we know, is just something else. But I really loved my gynecologist here, and I knew I could get into the hospital that also had a postpartum ward, even though we were in COVID. So I felt really happy about where I was going, but I also was like, I had been reading a lot of stuff about Pilates, like women who had strong core muscles and how it works with the baby and the, you know, separating of the ab muscles from, and all these sorts of things. And so I, from the beginning, I'd been really not consciously relaxing, like trying to keep everything as loose, stretch everything, because I knew my muscles were just like so locked up and so tight. And he just didn't want to come out. I went and went, and then they induced me, and they shoved every drug they could up there, and they try, and it just was like 1 centimeter, 1 centimeter, 1 centimeter. They put a balloon up there and inflated the balloon. I mean, they just couldn't.
Wow, they went circus on you.
So they went full circus. They were like, we're going to stick a balloon up there and we'll inflate it and see what. So I did, and then I had a C-section because he started crashing. He crashed a couple of times, and then they were like at that point, I think I was 28 hours into the hospital. Ooh, and
long.
You know, they do the Pitocin. I'm not a doctor, but there was something about, you know, that they can go up to 24 with Pitocin. So they go 2, 4, 6, 8, they keep increasing it. And every time they got to 6, it wasn't happening. And also when I got in there, and nothing was happening, and they hooked me up to the machines, and they're like, oh, you're having massive contractions. And you can see on the machine it's going off. And I was like, oh, I can't feel anything. But it was going up and holding for like 5 minutes, and I'd never really thought about it. And I'm like, oh, yeah, it's all my muscles are going like this. But they were crushing him, the poor little guy. But then once they started with the Pitocin, I was like, oh, that. Yes, I can feel that. Where's that man with the magical epidural? Yes, please bring him immediately. And then in the space of time that he came to give me the epidural, I thought, oh, you're such a wuss. I can't believe you've had like, you've felt like two contractions and you've, and then in the space of time that they were setting up to give it to me, I had another one and I was like, yeah, nah, let's go. Like, I don't know. Like I have got a strong pain threshold. I know I do. I've done a lot of painful things in my life, but that was something else. And, you know, and kudos to anyone who can, you know, everyone does things differently. And I don't know. My mum was a midwife. She had four cesareans. She's tiny as well. She's a very, very tiny little lady. And she worked a lot in refugee camps and she's seen a lot. And I've, through her, have heard a lot of stories and feel very strongly that, like, for me, you know, having access to first world hospital environments and spaces like that, I'm not trying to be a hero or, you know, it's that thing of like she would always say it. She's like, it can all be fun and games, and then at the last minute, and that's kind of how I felt like with what happened with me. Yeah. So I felt really lucky to be there and be in that space and to have access to everything that I had. And then, you know, so then they, you know, cut me over. My doctor was there and she was like, I can see an ear. And then he came out all screaming, yelling, and he was out. But then I could hear her saying to the other nurse while I was trying to throw up, not that I had anything to throw up, but I thought I might try and throw up. And she was saying, you know, we're going to take it very, she's like, I'm going to line these, you know, line my muscles back up really perfectly when she was stitching me back together, because that was, you know, that was the big thing was I was really like, what, you know, you just don't know. Is it going to go, am I going to go back together? Are they going to miss? Are they going to cut something that they're not meant to, you know? Yeah. So it was very strange coming back to then smashing myself with, you know, 100 hula hoops in the belly over and over again. I was like, ooh.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
I think as well with the labour and the pain, I haven't actually experienced labour, so I'm not speaking. I've had cesareans with all of my babies, but I don't think it's one size fits all with the pain and with that whole thing anyway. So I think everybody's having their own experience.
No, not at all.
And so when you
it's just that really simple thing that people seem to skip over. It's just that hundreds and thousands of women die in childbirth.
Oh, yeah.
It's not something that, it's not like, well, 100 years ago, no one used to. Yeah, but they were dying, literally horrible, and still to this day.
Yeah.
And you know, if I think personally, the things not even a baby, but moments where I've gone to hospital in my life. It's like, well, yeah, I would have died.
Yeah.
Like I just would have died. That's, you know, that's the alternative. Yeah. So, yeah.
No, I think it's, yeah. And you're right to remember that because, yeah, same here. I definitely would have died with my first 100%. And,
And I think it's partly the era that we're living through and stuff like that. But, you know, and even, but even in the hospital, everyone was, you know, what's your birth plan? You know, what's your birth plan? We need you to write up your birth plan. You know, what's, and I just kept saying on every form, I just wrote healthy baby, healthy baby, healthy baby. I was like, and if I get out of it, that's great. But all I want is, you know, a healthy baby. That's it. Don't need to talk about which herbal essence they're going to spray on me. You know, and obviously all that stuff was out the window anyway because it was COVID. So I was barely lucky to have my husband there with me. Yeah. But, yeah.
Well, I think you're right to have the emphasis on the healthy baby. And I can, you know, I think that's something that's always the focus on that because I think sometimes with the birth plan, I don't really know many people that have had the birth plan and then that's exactly the birth they've had anyway. I feel like it's just something you do to sort of process what's about to happen, maybe if you can. But when you first started getting back into your fitness, did you find anything had changed from before, or was it like
totally
really?
Everything was out the window because I'm so used to having a really tight core that I didn't realize how much, you know, just everything, walking, opening doors, getting in and out of cars, you know, all that sort of stuff. Not only was it like under stimulated because it hadn't been used for 9 months while I was growing a baby because it was, you know, it was all loose, but also it had all been literally cut open. So it was very interesting to kind of rebuild it basically from scratch because it was, you know, the street we live on, very LA, is very steep. And when I was pregnant, which now when I think about, I would not ever do that again. It was very odd, but my one thing was like, and it was lockdown, but I was like, oh, I'm just going to walk up and down the street 3 times, but it would take 45 minutes. It was very steep up and down. And after I'd had the baby, my doctor had said, I said, you know, what can I do? And she said, just try and even if it's 5 minutes, just go for a little walk every day if you're up for it. And I said, oh, you know, I'll do my walk up and down the street. And she said, no. She said, you can't. And I just, you know, we would drive to this park near the house that's flat up in Griffith Park. And we do this flat bit and my husband would have, you know, tiny little baby. And sometimes I'd be like, oh, I'm just going to get in. He was like, no, can't you see the incline is changing? And I would be like, oh, I'll be right. And then you'd take 2 steps and I'd be like, whoa. And it was like, oh, right, I can't do that yet. So it was really slow, again, lockdown, so I didn't feel any pressure. I didn't feel like, you know, I had to be back on stage 5 minutes later or anything like that. I felt like I had the time and I was breastfeeding and I was tired. And so I really, really went slow. As the thing I really wanted to do was swim. As soon as I could get back in the pool, I got in the pool. And just really, I think I was 10 or 11 weeks post-birth when I picked up a hoop and I was really like, let's just take it little time. Actually, I think I have a video of when I took some videos that sort of show when I first started through to like when I felt like I was back. And it was, I didn't rush. I just didn't rush. And I just thought, and I just knew so many stories about people that had, and either way, I don't think I was interested in rushing it. But that thing of rushing and having your abs, you know, you can't, you just, skin, muscles, they don't, there's no quick fix with any of that stuff. You can't just, you know, the snap back, you know, idea, you know, even if you're 16 or whatever, it needs time.
And I mean, do you think you even always wanted to be a mum? Was that always on the list for you or are you thinking about other things?
I definitely, you know, and I was 38 when I was pregnant, or 37. I was 38 when I had the baby, and I really had sort of made peace with like I was like, what's, you know, and a few years before that, I was like, what's left on the list? Like, I did the world records, I did the traveling, I wanted to go, you know, I traveled to the places I wanted to. Like, what's left on the list? Because I was like, I don't know what's going to happen, like. Not just in like, I don't know if my body's going to come back, but also I don't know if I'm going to want to. I don't know. And I
mean, sometimes there's such an expectation, isn't there, that everybody's going to want to have a baby, and that if you're a young woman, people have sort of an interest in it, even though maybe you're not even thinking about that, or you don't really want people. It's not an invited bit of interest that you've got from,
yep,
from other people. And, you know, you've been doing your own thing. And I suppose it sounds from, you know, from what you're saying, as if you weren't actually even sure if that was definitely something that you were headed towards, really.
Totally. And I was very, like, I used to get really angry when I was like that thing of being 25 or 26. And because I was touring all the time, you know, if I did see doctors, I was seeing different doctors for the first time in different countries. It wasn't even doctors. Sometimes it was physiotherapists. Sometimes it was someone who'd seen a show or whatever. And it was like everyone felt, it was like, you know, when someone's driving and they're wearing a skirt and the skirt's out of the door and you're like, oh my God, this skirt's going to go under the tire, and you're like flagging the car down, like, oh, I need to tell you that your skirt. It was like that, but they were like, you really need to think about having children. I just need to tell you, have you thought about having a baby? When are you going to have a baby? What are you? And I was like, do I know you? Like, I've come to you as a doctor because I have a sore throat or something. Like, why is everyone so involved in this idea that they need to tell me that my eggs are going to freeze up and that I'm going to not be able to have a kid? I was like, have you asked me if I've got a, who am I having the baby with? Who's looking after the baby? Who's going to pay for the baby? I was like, there's so many other things rather than this. Do I even want a baby? Like, all these questions that I was just like so mad that people felt that they, in this, that they felt that they really needed to tell me, you know, don't wait, don't wait.
But did it feel a little bit like if you were going to do it, if you're going to have a baby, then, you know, time was moving on and maybe it had to be now?
Yeah, I think that fed into a bit. But also I think the other thing is that I definitely, and you know, especially going home for this trip, you know, all the, you know, the people that you went to high school with and primary who come back and they're like, oh, you always said you were never going to have a kid. You were always anti-kids. And it wasn't that I was anti-kids, but I was anti this idea that everyone from the get-go was like, you know, when are you having the kid and what's your plan? And I was like, I've got other things to do. Like, there's so many things I want to do. And it wasn't that I was anti the kid, but I was like, what about career and life and travels? And I was very, I'm the oldest of four and there are big gaps between us. So I was like under no illusion about how much time I was going to be giving up and work I would be giving up. And I was, and I also was like, I didn't want to be, you know, being in LA, which is the land of this type of stuff, but that idea of like, I'm having the baby, I'm taking 2 weeks off work, then the nanny moving in full time, then I have a night nurse, and then I'm going to be, and I was like, I don't, why would you have the kid just to have someone else look after it? Like, if I'm going to do it, I want to spend time and be able to spend time and not be stressed about money and work and stuff like that. So I need to prepare now so that I can do that.
I mean, was there like a sort of turning point? Was there a moment where you thought, okay, I think I better do this now?
Yeah, I feel like I feel like, look, the thing that really was, I think I would have been sort of playing around with, like, you know, you test out whether you really feel, it's like any big major life decision. You're like, first it makes you feel sick, then you're like, do I really want to do this? And then you kind of play, you know, until you get to the bit of doing it for any project. And my gynecologist here was really funny. She kept saying, she'd always say, what birth control are you using? And I'd say, I'm not using birth control. And she'd say, well, you can't do that. And I said, well, if it happens, it happens. She said, no, you can't. You have to make a decision. I said, why? And then she said, I said, you know, I don't know. I don't know. You know, I just was very much in the sort of I don't know phase, which is usually the phase before the yes phase. But she was, she said, just go and do an egg count. She said, and just see, you know, and it doesn't, you know, let's just see what it says. And it was the process. It wasn't what it took me. That nothing came out of it. They just sort of said, you have the normal amount of eggs for a 37-year-old woman, which is not that many eggs, but it's normal for a 37-year-old. And I was kind of like, huh. But it wasn't that that really got me thinking. What really got me thinking was looking around the waiting room and being like, oh, this is like, I'm at the age now where you do, like, she's kind of, like, what my doctor had been saying is kind of right. Like, you need, because if it's not going to be straight, if you do want to do it and it's not going to be straightforward, then, you know, it's hard out there. And for some people, it doesn't just work. And I was like, okay, I should make a decision and I should think about when and how and all that kind of stuff. So it was definitely like a catalyst for it in the moment. And then it was that thing of like, yeah, that worked. That was easy. I was like, okay. And so
well, that's good.
Wasn't,
that is very
yeah,
good.
So that was real. So I feel, and I was saying this earlier to a friend today who's just found out she's pregnant, and she's a similar age to me. And it was this thing of like, I really deeply understand why it makes so much sense to be 16 and have a baby. Like, I get it. Like, it makes so much sense. But the way things are set up and the way, you know, that society and work and all these sorts of things, like, it also really makes sense to be 45. And so I feel like I have, you know, relatively good energy, and I feel like I scraped in, you know, like I'm exhausted in all the ways that I should be exhausted. And it probably would have been easier when I was 20, but I didn't even know my partner when I was 20, and I didn't have the house that we live in and all those sorts of things. So it was that, you know, finding that bit in between. So I just feel so lucky about how it worked out. And
anyway, the baby comes along, and that's the baby you were going to have then. And that's what happened.
Exactly.
There is no other life, but I do wonder where that real drive came from that you had with your work. I mean, so you said that your parents were both academics. Mm. So is there much about your childhood that you think might mirror the childhood that your son will have?
Yeah, it's funny. We were talking about this because I've very early on, very before we even thought we would have babies, I've been very clear with my husband, who is born and bred native LA, that that they would be going to school in Australia. Because, because I just, you know, I've lived on and off in America for years, and I just don't feel like that's the place for kids to go to school. That's me. That, you know, everyone feels.
So does Australia feel like home? Is that where you're when you think of home?
It does feel like home, but, and this is what I was talking to my friend about today, is I traveled right through to high school. We lived in Papua New Guinea. We lived in the Middle East. We traveled through Asia. I would do little bits of homeschooling. I'd be going to this school for 6 months and this school for that, you know, and I feel like I maybe didn't get, my mom always says, you know, I really missed out on grammar a little bit, but you know what I lacked in,
which would have been so helpful with the circus skills.
Exactly. So helpful. But then, you know, but the experiences we had, you know, on top, you can't compare it. Like, you know, I got to experience so many different cultures, so many different ways of living. Like, that's the stuff that really opened my eyes up to so much. And so, yeah, I feel similarly. I feel like maybe, you know, we've got time to still travel, live in some different countries. Not like, you know, I'm not excited about like getting a backpack and one of those bikes where you load up lots of stuff on a bike and no, I'm not a bit too showgirl for that. it would be nice to, you know, maybe move around for a few more years but then be in one place. And Australia for me is where you can have a really great childhood, like a real childhood. And I have, you know, friends who have kids in New York, and they're like little adults. They're like, I'm like, did you get to climb enough trees and things like that, you know? And I think you can in the right places. But yeah, I really cherish, I always talk about like my favorite age was when I was 8. It was this amazing year where I was very aware of like the world got a lot bigger, but I still had that like innocence of, there wasn't a fear around it. And I was literally barefoot on a tropical island eating mangoes out of a tree, and life was great. And it was it was just such a time where I'm like, I feel like unless you're on a tropical island or, you know, in somewhere remote, that maybe some kids miss out on that because the real world is like right there on the doorstep.
But when you've had an experience like that, where it's so crystallized in your childhood, and it's kind of almost technicolor and very free and sort of very in the moment, do you think there is a part of that emotion that ended up being intrinsic to what you ended up doing for a living? Is there something that carries over when you do something that's extraordinary?
Totally. And I think it's, and it's that thing of chasing it, you know, you want to be back there. Definitely. And I think, I was, you know, when I think about all those things leading up, when I think about what I did, you know, weird performances that in high school and things that I wanted, things that I saw. I think Stomp are having their 30-year anniversary or something this year.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Like, I remember when Stomp came to Australia.
I remember when it came to London.
And I was just like, this is amazing. Like, I was like, mind was blown. And then I spent the next 2 weeks spinning a rubbish bin lid on my finger. And then my mum took me, and it's so embarrassing, my mum took me and the rubbish bin lid to the rhythmic gymnastics school that was near our house and said, what can you do with her? And then they took the rubbish bin lid and gave me a ribbon and a ball and a hoop and some clubs. And I was like, oh, yeah, I got it.
That's amazing though, isn't it, when you suddenly realise that all these other people out there exist. And I mean, I was reading something where you were saying about other people that influenced you, and people like Josephine Baker and Esther Williams, all these people who were actually like living extraordinary lives and putting forward their shows are so incredible. Yeah. And actually, especially with Josephine Baker, when you're performing, you do quite sort of big caricature-y, cartoony expressions. Do you think that kind of came from, because she does that when she's dancing, which is brilliant.
Yeah, so I was in a show, I'm trying to think where I was. I think I was in London, and I can't remember how he found me, but it was an Australian producer who was putting on a show in New York, and he said, oh, we really want you to be in the show and to play Josephine Baker. And I was like, again, with the Josephine Baker thing, I was like, everyone keeps saying, I'm not the only mixed race girl that like dances on it. I'm like, why does everyone keep saying that? And he was like, oh, you know, it's the faces. And this was like, you know, YouTube had only just sort of kicked off. And I was like, you know, I think I'd seen a picture of her in a banana skirt and that was it. And I was like, I don't know, you know, but he was like, you know, we want you to audition for the show. And, you know, so I was like, okay, let me go find out more about this person. And I Googled it and I was like, oh, I was like, we do. Yes. The faces thing. I was like, oh my God. And I was like, really bizarre, like watching, you know, and at the time, like it's changed a lot, obviously in the last 10, 15 years, but there was very few, the videos were terrible quality and you could only get very strange little snippets. But I was like, oh yeah, no, this is really amazing. And then back to the children thing, you know, one of the things that when people used to always, you know, that stupid high school stuff of like, you know, if you're never going to have children, like, well, you're never going to have children, also, all that stuff about children. But I would always say, oh, I'm going to adopt. You know, I'd always say, I'm going to adopt because, you know, I'll be older when I want to do it, kind of thing. And then reading about Josephine Baker and how she had the 12 adopted children, the Rainbow Tribe, and how she'd had
12.
You know, she had 12. She adopted. So the jury's out. There's a version that says that she had a baby, but a stillborn baby. Whether or not she ever had a baby, she adopted 12. And they were all from different countries. They all spoke different languages, and they spoke English, French, and then whatever their native language was, she had a nanny that taught them that thing. And they lived literally in a castle. This is in the heyday, and it didn't end great. They lost the castle and stuff. But she had the Rainbow Tribe, and she had the 12 kids. And when, you know, like there's this whole thing about like, you know, MLK and the civil rights movement, like when he was assassinated, she was the first person they asked to take over the civil rights. Like people don't know how much, they were just like, oh, the one in the banana skirt with no top on. And I'm like, no. There's like the craziest story. So then I got really fascinated and was trying to get my hands on any information I could. And now there's tons, but at the time, you know, I felt like I was really trawling through things to get information. And then I got into the show, and then I played her for 6 months in New York. And in New York, on 42nd Street between 10th and 11th, is Chez Josephine, which is the restaurant that one of the adopted sons runs as like an homage to her, which has like life size, like huge paintings, picture, like just the most incredible French, fabulous, like pre when you go to a Broadway show, you go to Chez Josephine and have.
That sounds fun.
Dinner or go afterwards, and they have piano, and it's where Harry Connick Jr. as a teenager played piano, and that's where he cut his teeth. And it was a great, incredible restaurant. But I was terrified of him finding out that I was playing Josephine, and I had Marco Nuchli, my German flatmate, who he was doing straps in the show, and he was like, "We have to go. We just have to go to the restaurant." So we went to the restaurant, and he was German. So they were speaking in German to each other, going back and forth in German. And then Marco was like, what do you do? And he was loving Marco and, you know, doing it. And he was like, oh, I'm an acrobat. We're doing a show, blah, blah, blah. He's like, the show is about Paris and blah, blah, blah. And then he turned to me and he said, you should be playing Josephine. And I was like, oh, thank God. I was like, I am.
That's amazing.
And then it was amazing because every Friday for the duration of the show, I would go and have dinner there. And he would announce me when I would enter the restaurant and he would tell me stories and show me things. And it was just the most incredible time to be not only playing her in the show but learning so much every, you know, I just felt like I got such a incredible insight to it. I felt really, you know, lucky to get to get that close to it.
When you find those, I suppose what we're talking about as well, it's like sort of kindred spirits, like the other performers, where I feel like they're probably, you know, delving into a similar part of their, you know, psyche to sort of be able to bring that show. And I did wonder, when you're about to walk out on stage and you have to bring what you bring, is there a sort of place you go in your head, like a show that you're playing in your head, that helps you get into that right headspace to be able to do it?
Yes, and it varies. Depends on the show, I guess, a little bit, but often I just listen to really I listen to a lot of like Pusha T or like really full on like hip hop, like blaring in my headphones.
Really?
That gets me. I don't know why, but that's usually where I am pre-show. And then I'm like, I am going to go out there. I'm going to throw some hula hoops. I'm going to break some stuff. Like by the time I get out there,
get yourself pumped.
Yeah, really pumped. Yeah.
And do you think you're going to, now that you've had your baby and you're sort of the other side of that bit where you felt like, okay, I'm going to have the kid and I've done the world records and I've done so many things already. We haven't even really talked about your world records. I think, is it 12 that you've got, right?
Well, yes, but the thing that, the really big news for me with world records, I didn't know I was getting it. I was actually pregnant when I found out. So it was just like the most incredible bonus is I found out that I have, and last year I was inducted into the Hall of Fame, Guinness World Record Hall of Fame, and I have two pages in the current book dedicated to all the records, which I really was like, that's it.
That's amazing. And every day do you wake up like, please let no one have spun 201 hula hoops?
100%, 100%, yeah. No, it was funny. I think I was like that for a long time, like, when I was working on records and getting more records, and I used to be like, you know, I could break into a sweat just thinking about it. And then again, like somewhere along the line, I was just like, you know what? I'm kind of, I feel like I'm at peace with it. Like, you know, then there was a guy in at the same circus school that I went to, and he was like, I mean, he had to be close to 6 foot, and he specialized in hula hooping. And I found myself, rather than being like furious about it, because all the other people that had the hoop record before me had always been taller, because really it just comes down to how many, you know, and I'm quite short.
Of course, yeah, like, if you've got a lot taller body, you're going to be able to put more hoops there.
Exactly, exactly, you're going to fit them. And so I was just like, my initial thing was like, oh no, this is it. And then I was like, no, I can train him. I can, he could do like 300 hoops. I can fit so, you know. And so, yeah, I felt like I was at peace with it.
You could get the world record for training the most amount of hula hooping world record holders.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. And that's I have a troop of girls in London that I teach that I hula hoop with, and I'm always like trying to, you know, psych them into doing more bigger and better things. And I've all, you know, even when I started, I liked to teach. I've always liked teaching, and even more so now, I feel like with the experience, not just in the performing, but all the other aspects of it, you know, how to run it, how to have, you know, how to do the invoices and how to do all those sorts of things. I feel really passionate about like sharing it with, you know, the up and coming next gen.
Well, I can see that in you, and I love that. And I love that you do the teaching and the majorettes. And I wanted to touch a little bit on the book. What made you want to write your book?
I wanted the book. It had stuck with me because I remember being frozen, petrified, like at the thought whenever they tell you at school and whatever my mum had said. I remember my mum giving me a pad and saying, you know, you should just keep this in your bag in case you ever need it kind of thing. And I was just like, oh my God, this is another really unfair thing about being a woman. And why do I just thought it was the biggest injustice of all time. And I was paralyzed with fear of when it was going to happen, you know, just like, when, like, is it going to happen right now? Is it going to happen in the next 5 minutes? Do I need to, you know, just paralyzed. It was, I was terrified. And then when it happened, I was like, this is so much worse than I even could have imagined. This is just horrific. Like, it's terrible. And then, you know, and then I got it. And then I very dutifully went to my diary and did, you know, I thought if I write P, then everyone's going to know. Like, I was like, what can I? So I did like a circle or some weird shape that I was like, no one will know what this means, and carefully went through and every 28 days marked it, and then did something a couple of days before. So, and then of course it doesn't come every 28 days. It was like 26 days, 28 to 29 days, 24 days, because I was still, you know, and so I was like, well, what is this? Now it's the, and I was just like, and my mum, you know, she obviously, she worked in health and stuff, and so she had these prehistoric textbooks that were like, you know, size 8 font with long descriptions. And I was like, this isn't really, and also they were from the 70s. I was just like, this is terrifying. This is unhelpful. I'm not asking anyone. And also the internet didn't exist or anything like that. So I was just like terrified and miserable and, you know, and boobs and stretch marks and sweat and all of it was just like all of it. And, you know, and no one, you know, went to an all-girls school, and it was like, the only comments were sort of either bitchy backhanded comments, or no one, it didn't really feel like you could actually, you never wanted to expose yourself to reveal to anyone any of it. And I also had this furious, probably slightly competitive side to me that was just like, you know, I was doing a lot of athletics and sport and stuff like that. And I was like, I will not spend 3 days in bed, because I had crippling pain. I had, you know, I had really painful periods and felt like terrible. I just felt, wanted to sleep. I just wanted to sleep. And I was saying this to my sister, because there's two girls, two boys in our family. And I mean, I've talked about this with a lot of friends, but it's that thing of like, you know, that you hit that teenage hormonal thing.
Yeah.
And boys just sleep. They just sleep all day. And it's like, oh, they're boys, they're sleeping. But with girls, it's like, oh, you need to go to the doctor. There's something wrong with you. Oh, yeah, we've got to put you on all these different, you know, you need to take this tablet or this supplement, or you need to do this, or you need. And I said, why don't we get to sleep?
Yeah.
I haven't slept all day. Like, you know, it's like, why? Yeah. So I sat on that and was furious about that for what, another 15 years or something? And then the opportunity to do the book came, and I was like, I know exactly. Like, I had it, you know, I know that writing books can be, I mean, books are difficult. They're difficult. But in terms of writing it, it was already percolated in my head. And yeah, I think when I did the first brain dump, it was 70 lessons. And then we refined it, and it was, in the end, it's 50 lessons. So it's everything that I wish someone had said to me. And it's really, I find it really, it's in 22 languages now. So
amazing.
You know, I remember having the marketing meeting with them, and I was sort of, Instagram was really popping at that time, and I was like, you know, we should do this Instagram campaign. And they were like, no, you can't do any Instagram campaigns, because the book is being targeted or marketed to kids that are, you know, you're not allowed to be on Instagram till you're 13. I'm thinking, they're all on Instagram. And sure enough, every day I'm getting messages from kids in Germany, kids in Japan. You know, they're all on Instagram. I mean, they shouldn't be, but they are. But all the messages are just like so, you know, comforting and satisfying because I just really relate to them, because they're like, oh, the chapter about the shooty bum pains was, I thought I was dying, but it was so nice to read that, you know, and oh, you know, I felt so embarrassed about this, but now I can talk to my mum about it. And a lot of messages from mums and dads too, who were like, I didn't want to have to bring this stuff up. And, you know, we've been able to have really great conversations, either that they've had really great conversations or thanks that I didn't have to do.
Yeah, and also, you know, now we're mothers of sons. We have to, like, actually tell them what goes on as well, so that they know and they can be
exactly. Yeah, and a lot of people that have. Yeah, and a lot of people, either that they've got boys and girls, you know, brothers and sisters, where the boys have read it to, or even just people that just have sons who've also passed it on to read, and it's been, and when I talk at schools, like they often they'll ask, you know, oh, should we just have, and I said, no, it's girls and boys always.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating, you know, it's really fascinating when I do the talks at schools, because the kids, they always say the same thing. They say, you know, oh, they're at a really awkward age and they don't really like to, they're not going to really ask you any questions, and you know, you'll probably just need to keep it moving and keep reading or whatever. And every time I go in and I tell, there's three stories and there's really three unbelievably embarrassing, like revoltingly embarrassing stories, and just horrific. And I read the worst one, which you'll just have to go and see it. It's compulsion. Real bad.
I put all the embarrassing stories in my book as well. It's like, why did I do that? But then it just kind of,
yeah.
Like I obviously felt like I needed to overshare something, but
yeah, exactly. And but it's amazing, because as soon as you do that, as soon as I read the story and then I say, are there any questions? I mean, that's it. It's, you know, they want to know how big's it, you know, if my fingers is big, how big's the tampon, how far up does it have to go, and how much blood, you know, what happens here, and what does this, you know, and they get really wild questions, and then the boys start asking questions, and then it, you know, it goes all the way. And it's great. It's great because it's just stuff that doesn't, you know, often takes a long, I feel like, you know, sometimes it, I can see on the kids as well, like that thing of like, they might've been thinking it for so long and just waiting for a way to be able to ask it. And then all of a sudden it's just like, you know, and another thing, and what about this? And oh, let me, and you can see the relief when there's like, okay, you know,
yeah,
I can talk about it.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's really, our communication's always brilliant. And it's I think those things, I think we're getting better at not being squeamish about it, actually.
Yeah, and I think I really feel for the, you know, younger kids now, because the other thing, and I did this with the book, is that what's terrifying for me is that so many of the subjects, so many of the things that you would want, you know, I was like, well, I took the book and the questions from the book and I sat in front of my computer and I was like, okay, this is 8-year-old me. I'm going to type. I know what I would have typed. I know what I would have searched. Every time it's like, it's straight to porn and straight to misinformation, like crazy misinformation.
Oh, crazy.
And I was like, if this is what these kids are Googling and this is what they're seeing, I'm like, this is not the one.
No, I know. That's that's a whole other conversation. But yeah, I'm conscious of your time, Mara, because also I know that we've been very patient with me with all the tech stuff as well. So I just wanted to ask you a couple of things I always ask everybody. And I think this will be really interesting with you, considering as well how much thought you've put into the moment where you said, yeah, okay, let's do the baby bit. But are you the kind of mother that you thought you'd be?
Yep, I think so.
Oh, that's the nicest answer. Yes, I am. Okay, great. I mean, yes, you are. I guess you are. I just bought your kid roller skates, so yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to think of the things that have been surprising. I think also it's that thing of like, I'm not 20, you know, I'm 40 now. So I feel like I was prepared, I think, for a lot of things. I think the things that I wasn't prepared for were, I think I'm a little bit more protective than I thought I would be in the playground and stuff. I find myself being like, oh, don't go over there. Oh, you know.
Really? I thought you'd be like, climb that tree.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, off you go, climb up. No. I'm like, your body's perfect. Let's not break anything. Everything is in perfect alignment.
Don't break yourself. Yeah. I get the feeling, though, as your son gets older and sees a little bit more about what his mum is capable of, he's going to be like, I don't think you're the one to tell me that.
Yeah. I think I've got a real paranoia around how hard all the floors are in our house and their heads. I mean, I know they can fall on their heads, but God.
No, that's horrible. And those things never really leave you, you know. Like,
no.
I sometimes go to bed at night and then I get this little series of images of just horrific accidents happening, like a little montage.
Yeah.
So
don't
worry.
I'm reading a lot of is it Philippa Perry?
She's brilliant. The book
Yeah, all of that. But everything she writes, like she does the bits in The Guardian, I read everything. Yeah. I'm obsessed.
She seems so sensible. I know. I love
so,
it too.
Yeah, so sensible. But
the other thing I wanted to ask you, what is the thing about having a nomadic childhood like that, where you said you travelled around a lot, What's the thing about that kind of childhood that you think is different to a childhood that's in one place? Because I think it's probably quite a defining thing, like being people you've had that.
I think it's, look, it's, you know, living in the, you know, we're very aware now of carbon footprints and, like, you know, I've always, you know, obviously as a kid we traveled a lot, and it was for work for my parents, and I traveled for work as well, and that was sort of my way of always justifying of being like, well, I have, you know, I'm not going on holiday, I'm working, but that, you know, putting carbon footprint aside, I just think it's got to be like one of the most important. I mean, I also come from mixed culture backgrounds. My dad's Somali, my mum's Australian. You know, we've got the two different cultures already at home. And then traveling and just being able to, I did sociology and psychology at university before I went to
school. Oh, wow.
I did 2 years of that, 2 years of that first. And I always remember I loved those subjects so much. And I remember that there was this lecturer who would ask this question of like, what's something that's acceptable in all cultures? You know, what's something you can do, a gesture or a grit, you know, things like that. And people it would always be the same people in the class. They'd be like, you know, a stupid, you know, a handshake. Handshake's universal. You can do that in any country. You know, there's no country that you couldn't do a handshake. Everybody knows that, you know. And I'd just be like, I was always just like, no, like, there's nothing. Like, you know, there's, you know, there's just everything and anything in the world. And how do you explain, you know, in the Middle East where you see men walking around in effectively a dress, dish dasher, you know, with their pinky fingers, you know, linked, walking as two men with their two wives walking behind them. And in a country that's really, you know, we can see is very behind in terms of acceptance of same-sex marriage and stuff like that. You know, how do you explain all these little nuances and then food, because I love to eat, and just flavor, like my mum would cook, and, you know, experiencing different ways of cooking, and I feel like, you know, super lucky to be able to sort of take all these little bits, all my favorite bits of all these different cultures and all these different customs and put that into one space. But I just think it's so, especially for children, like it's so important. I'm reading, I'm really obsessed with Colors magazine. It's Colors, like the US spelling. It's Italian, old Italian magazine. Or the guy that founded it was Italian, but it was like, he's the same guy that did all the Benetton ads in the 80s and 90s. Okay. And it's just like the most, I think it's called something like a magazine about the world or about the rest of the world or something like that. And it's just like, it's really full on. Like I would buy it as a kid, and there were issues that I probably, there was an issue on wall that was like, there's a lot of very graphic photos and stuff like that probably I was a bit too young to be looking at, but I think they've started up again, but I think they ran for about maybe 15 years. And, but it's that thing of like looking at all these different cultures, all these different things that are in the world, like I don't know why we're bothering with Mars, even the moon. Like there's so much here that we still haven't unpacked. That's just, it's just crazy what's out there. And I think the more that children can see other cultures and see other people's ways. And I was also lucky because when we traveled, we went to international primary schools, and international primary schools, the ones that I went to, at least I had really incredible experiences of like experiencing lots of different cultures. You know, and I think this also feeds into, you know, why I love the Olympics and why I love Guinness World Records and these sort of celebrations of differences and specialties rather than conflict between different cultures and finding ways to celebrate all of it.
That's a lovely way to put it, actually. And I guess that's what you get as well, crosses over into show and circus and all those things. It's about taking someone who looks like they're going to do one thing and then they do something totally different, and it surprises you and it's unique and it's celebrated. And you also think how wonderful that there's a place where that quirky little talent that you have, that you've honed, can now be put out there in front of everybody. Totally. I love it.
Totally.
Yeah. It's kind of magnificent. Yeah, totally.
It's literally exactly. Yeah. It's literally what circus is. Yeah. It's that thing of taking someone's, you know, skill or oddity or whatever the thing is and celebrating it. And yeah, that's what was great about shows like when we were at that show in the Hippodrome and in the Spiegel tents and, you know, that were
beautiful.
Just, yeah.
I think you're going to be roller skating till the end of your days, by the way. I can't imagine that.
I hope so. I've got enough pairs at this point. Yeah.
You'll be up there. Oh, you know what? It's been so lovely to speak to you. I'm honestly such a huge fan. I hope you come over to London soon and I can see you perform again.
Yes.
And please, can you teach me to hula hoop a bit better? I'd love to do one of your classes.
Yeah. You just need a bigger hoop. It's not you. You just need a bigger hoop. I say this to everyone. Anyone who thinks that they can't hula hoop anymore, let me tell you right now, the ones from the pound shop, the 99-cent store hoops, they're for very small children.
Yes.
It needs to be up to your hip.
And a good weight? Heavy.
So
or does
you
it not
can
matter
still do it. And yeah, not too heavy, but it needs to be the ones from the, you know, those really super light ones.
Yeah,
they're very small. They're no one can hoop. I can't hoop. They're too small. You need bigger hoop.
And it's
not you. It's the hoop.
Back and forward, not side to side, right?
I say, I say it's not like the dance. You're not actually doing circles. You can actually make it like a sit-up. That's why my core is so tight, because every time I push the hula hoop, it's like I do a sit-up. It's like a crunch. So you're pushing like there's a string in your belly button and you go forwards and backwards.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, can we start off with that?
And then you don't get lopsided.
Okay, well, we'll start off with that. Yeah. Then I'll do a little bit of roller skating and then we'll combine the two. And if all else fails, I'll give you a giggle. See, that was a cool chat, wasn't it? And yes, I have bought Marowa's Teenage Girl Handbook. It's really excellent. As you can see, she's a smart woman with things she wants to, knowledge she wants to impart that go beyond how to be great on hula hoops and roller skates. Although, to be honest, that would be enough to offer the world, quite frankly. During lockdown, I bought some hula hoops. I was like, this is it. I'm going to learn how to hula hoop. I'll be doing it on stage. I'll be singing and hula hooping just like Grace Jones. It's going to be great. I was rubbish. I know you're supposed to go forward and back and not side to side with the hula hoop, but that is the tip of the flipping iceberg. Anyway, never mind. There's someone else doing it better than me, so you don't need to wait for me to learn the skill. Just go and see Marowa. She's awesome. And I'm now nearing my destination. I'm about to walk through. We have like a little antiques market. Thank you. Sorry. Around here. A woman just waited for me while I walked past and she looked fabulous, all dressed in shades of purple and pink. Anyway, yes, I'm approaching my home and going through the antique market, which weirdly I've never been to. They've got vintage clothing there, but it's almost too easy for me to go and see it. Also, I think it's like proper stuff, as in things that are worth money. And my house is full of tat, so I think it's a bit too highbrow for me. Anything that describes itself as antique market has probably not got things that I will desire, because it'll be proper. I like the cheap stuff, please. And I hope you're having a lovely day or evening, whatever you're up to. And, I've got some excellent guests for you coming up. Oh, my word. I already spoke last weekend on Radio 2 with Rylan about how I've just interviewed Mary Berry. So that might be next week or the week after. And I've got another couple of cool ones as well. And in the meantime, there's loads of dogs around. In the meantime, have a lovely day. Thank you for lending me your ears again. And thanks for listening to Marowa. And maybe, should we get some roller skates out? I've got mine in the attic. Maybe I'll give it another go. I did used to love it so much when I was a kid. She makes it look such a fun way to keep fit as well. Yep, that'll be me now. Roller skating my way around Chiswick. All right, see you soon, my darlings. Lots of love.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.